And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
It's so classic flying saucer, really, standing in the clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello, and welcome to the show. It's a great one tonight. I'm looking forward to it. Our guest tonight is John Greenwald Jr., and I've been trying to get him on the show for a long time, and finally, alas, he's on the show. It'll be great to talk to him later on. First of all, we have Alejandro Rojas coming up with the news. And before that, I just want to say we have a new blog that actually ties in with tonight's show. It's called FOIA is Giving All Our Secrets Away. And that's by Charles Lear, who writes blogs now for us about once a week. Actually, he's been doing pretty steady for every week. So check that out on podcastufo.com. I want to thank everyone that supports the show. Without your support, we couldn't be doing this. Costs actually quite a bit to do the show, and it's a gold-plated problem. It's become fairly popular. I had to get a dedicated server. I use bandwidth for the show, stuff like that. So it's all really, I'm very grateful to all the listeners out there, and I want to thank you. And for right now, I'm going to bring in my one and only Alejandro Rojas buddy. How you doing, Alejandro?
Hey, doing pretty good. How you doing?
Great, great. So what is happening in the world of UFOs today?
Yeah, well, you know what? I just got late breaking news. I don't know much about this story yet, but it's an interesting headline. It's written by Tyler Rogaway. Have you had him on?
I have. And this, yeah. Just to let the listener know, this just happened while we just connected and you said, hey, this just came across the wire, so to speak, just popped up online right now.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's exciting because Tyler tweeted earlier today, and for people who don't remember, he's a defense writer for this website called The Drive. It's kind of a Time Warner website. And he writes particularly for the War Zone. So he writes about, jets and aerospace defense type of things. And just recently, at least in the last year or so, he's also been posting some incredible UFO cases that he comes across. In fact, he's told me before that if someone in aerospace says they don't believe in UFOs or are, at least aren't interested, I shouldn't say believe, but aren't interested, then they're lying. He says that at least the interest is that pervasive throughout the community. Something I wasn't aware. Of course, I knew many people were interested. But earlier today, he tweeted, big post coming out today. You will find it highly interesting if you're into mysterious facilities and secret aircraft. And then he sent me a private message that said, look close for hints in this. So, of course, when I saw the original tweet, I was already excited. So that he literally just must have hit send on his Twitter right before the show started. And here's the headline, Vandenberg Air Force Base Space Shuttle Processing Facility now has a very mysterious mission. The base's old orbiter processing facility offers high security and isolation, as well as ease of operation and access to vast sanitized airspace. So there must be some sort of operation running out of here that he has a hint of that he's explaining here in the article. Haven't had a chance to read it, but he's been very mysterious in telling us to, you know, take a look at this. And so I'm excited to read it. But people can find that on Twitter. If they follow my Twitter, I've retweeted it. But I'll put it on all of our social media out there. And, of course, then you all can find it and post it on the Podcast UFO media as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something interesting that just happened, late breaking news. Otherwise, there's a lot of news out there. So we do have for the Unidentified television show History Channel is running. That's going to be covering a bit of ATIP, and it's going to essentially, it looks like Lou Elizondo is going to be kind of the main guy on it. But Of course, what he's doing with To the Stars is going to be in there. And at least I've been able to have a look at some still photos. And Steve Justice, it seems like, will play a pretty big role in it as well. And then, of course, Tom DeLonge will be in it somewhat. But it doesn't seem like he's going to be in throughout the show. But bits and pieces. It's hard to say for sure. But the show is going to be starting on May 31st. So that's the first time we've heard about this. So late May that will come out. Also, I did post another story called From OSAP to ATIP. And that's essentially, a lot of people have been wondering, including your guest today has been writing about this, kind of how did it happen? Why are there two different names? Why did the New York Times cover one name? What was the nature of how did this transition happen? What's going on here? So I did write a story about it, and I did interview Elizondo to try to clear these things up, because this has been a big problem for me also. I've been really confused about this, and it really hasn't made sense to me. Now, when I asked Lou about it, he felt like he had talked so much about it that, you know, all of the info was out there, but it was hard to piece it all together. So at least I think myself and many others were confused, despite of what he had already posted out there or talked about at symposiums or different talks. So the gist of it is, and George Knapp, at least in my interview, gave me some of this, but OSAP, the Advanced Aerospace Weapons System Application Program, was the beginning. So the New York Times touched on this a bit, and I'll have an article really laying all this out, more for the layman who is not up to speed on all of this, on Den of Geek later this week. But a DIA agent read Skinwalker, the Skinwalker book, said, "I want to go to Skinwalker," right? We know this through George Knapp, and the New York Times hinted at it. They said, the New York Times said the DIA official was going to meet Bigelow at his ranch where he did research. What they did not mention, of course, is what this ranch was, where this ranch was, and the significance of this ranch. What we know, of course, about this ranch is that it's Skinwalker Ranch, where a lot of craziness has happened. So this guy goes out there. He has his own personal experience that is supposedly remarkable. Now, the name of the person who went out there, they've kept anonymous, and they haven't given details about what happened. But the New York Times article said after this guy met Bigelow, then some DIA officials went to Senator Reid and said, "We want to start a research program." And this is kind of how this all started. However, what we've heard from Knapp and others is that OSAP was looking primarily into Skinwalker Ranch. And, of course, Skinwalker has UFO stuff attached to it. We've seen some of that in the book, but also in Jeremy Corbell's documentary about the Skinwalker. So what happened was, essentially, as soon after OSAP began and they were looking into these paranormal issues, of which were really weird. I mean, George Knapp released a statement by a manager with Bass who outlined some really weird stuff that they were looking into. But people got wind of this, and they didn't like it inside the DIA. Essentially, George has talked about this, Lou has talked about this, that there were these religious factions who felt that this was demonic and that we shouldn't be messing with it. So they sought to take the program down. At this time, seeing the writing on the wall, they pulled out, they made a subgroup within OSAP that was just military UFO cases, and that was ATIP. When Lou came on, he just worked on ATIP. And then eventually they were right. OSAP was taken down. It was just too controversial for the people inside the DIA. But fortunately, they had pulled out the UFO program and for this reason to save it. And that continued. Lou then took that over in 2010, and ATIP continued and allegedly continues to this day. This is information, though, that Lou gave me that's kind of interesting. ATIP no longer has the same name. Why? A bit of a similar reason OSAP moved to ATIP, that ATIP is getting too much attention. So in order to keep this new program, you know, discreet and to keep eyes off of what they're doing, they changed the name. Lou doesn't even know the name, nor does he want to know the name, essentially, because they're keeping it secret. So, but he does know who's involved, essentially who his predecessor is, and that this work is still going on.
Well, one
so
thing,
that's essentially the.
Yep. Yeah, pardon, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but
No problem.
What about the funding? Because that, you know, that supposedly had ceased.
It is a good point. Well, there's a number of things when it comes to the funding. First of all, the funding was for OSAP. That went from 2007 to 2012. Of course, ATIP was a part of OSAP, so ATIP received some of that funding, that division, essentially, of OSAP. Otherwise, after 2012, Lou has received, at least mentioned at a MUFON symposium, that he received other funding in a joint IC project. What that often means is that some group received funding and that the mission of this project they received funding for was similar to what ATIP was doing, so they were able to work together on it, and ATIP got some data from that. What Lou has also said is similar things have happened in the past where they were able to get data from, like, you know, he gave the example of satellites looking for nukes coming out of, or missiles coming out of North Korea. Well, if they got anything that fit certain parameters that ATIP was looking for, then they were able to get some data for that. So essentially, they've kind of gone around and asked for data from other programs that might have data for sort of things they were looking for. In fact, there's a guy, Philippe, from France, who did a great presentation at the SCU in Alabama, and he was showing us how there all of these satellites that are out there are collecting data, and a lot of this data is going into these major databases. So if we could create partnerships with some of these satellite creators and these for access to these databases, it would be something that UFO groups should do, because then we'd be able to say, hey, we had this great sighting here, go to these databases and get satellite imagery from that area and see if we see whatever it was the witnesses saw. Nobody's kind of doing that yet, but that was the gist of his presentation, to show that there's a lot of data out there. So certainly that's a similar sort of thing apparently that they did within ATIP.
I see. Hey, by the way, some astute person on YouTube was asking where your floating UFO went. Did you sell it? I know you were selling.
Oh, where am I floating? No, well, we did. And what happened was essentially, okay, that's so funny that people ask. One of them broke for a customer.
You mean
so,
it crashed?
That was the last one. It crashed. Yep. And that was the last one we had, was my sample. So I had to send him my personal one that I had been using. Wow. So to replace their broken one, because, you know, but we are getting a new batch of those in like tomorrow. So they fly. They go really fast. All we got was 5 silver and 5 gray. So they're probably going to sell out within the next week. So if you want one, go to the UFOCongress.com store and get it as soon as possible. We do have them up for presale because they're going to go quickly.
You mean they fly off the shelves. They don't actually fly. They just float,
fly off the shelves. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
One last thing I think is interesting is the New York Times part, because essentially, well, why didn't the New York Times use the term OSAP? Essentially, Lou said, I didn't work for OSAP. I worked for ATIP. They never asked me about OSAP or the paranormal. It wasn't my place to even talk about that, so I didn't. And you will see that there's a lot of things that Lou doesn't talk about until that information is leaked by a third party. Typically, that's George Knapp. Once the information gets out there, then he's able to share it. And George Knapp, a lot of what it seems he's gotten, he says he's gotten from D.C., and it seems like, you know, this is an assumption, but I'm guessing he's getting that from Reed or Reed's office, something like that. But I can't say for sure. I don't know. He has not explicitly said that.
Huh, about that. Well,
yeah, so there's some background there. Otherwise, I'll review just a couple real quick stories.
You bet.
Just that there's a couple good things out there. There's an article in the Star Tribune about why scientists are starting to listen to UFO believers, and we're starting to see a lot of stories along these lines. Mm-hmm. And essentially, they're reviewing MUFON, they're reviewing the Pentagon program, and talking about, hey, some of these guys are more credible than we thought. Also, the Detroit Free Press covered the Bob Lazar documentary. That's kind of getting a renewed interest, which is kind of interesting. I know it's going to be in a film festival here soon. And then this is the last one I'll cover. Otherwise, the other stuff is kind of similar to what we've seen before. But, well, two things. First of all, UFO fun shuns little green men to buy satellites and rockets. So you're going to see the ticker symbol, UFO now when you're looking at, you know, these different markets. But unfortunately, it's not a UFO company that has taken that. It's an actual UFO fund that is funding satellites and rockets and space programs. But yeah, now on the stock exchange sticker, you're going to see the UFO symbol.
That's
and that's
funny.
What it is. Huh. The other thing is that there was a really interesting meeting by there was a Senate hearing on the Space Force, and Senator Blumenthal had some really odd things to say. We've got links to all of this at Open Minds TV right on the front page. But he said that there's some scary stuff essentially going on in space, that our adversaries know that we know about this. We discuss this in classified meetings, but the public has no idea. So the public has no context for these conversations that we're having about security in space. And we really need to let the public in on what's happening here and the threats from space.
How about
really
that?
Odd verbiage. And it's kind of scary, really. Of course, a lot of UFO people are thinking, oh, he's got to be talking to UFOs and aliens and stuff like that. We don't know that for sure. He did say adversaries, but some very interesting verbiage that he used in this video.
Yeah, adversaries. Wow. Klingons. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right.
Yep. The Klingons.
All right, man. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you. Have a good show.
Okay. I'll talk to you next week.
Talk to you later.
All right. So our guest this evening is John Greenwald Jr., and I met him out in Phoenix. Oh, I would say it was 2 years ago. I'll ask him because I can't remember. Something like that. Because 1 year I got stuck in a snowstorm, never made it out there. But I think it was about 2 years ago. Anyway, I've been trying to get him on the show almost since day one. We finally connected, and here he is. He's been actually looking at this topic and doing active work since he was 15 years old. And here he is, John Greenwald. How are you? Welcome to the show.
I'm good. Yeah, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. It's good to be here. I'm glad we finally met up. I know it's been a long time, so I appreciate your patience on that.
Yep. Well, I always thought that I'd like to have you on. Right off the bat, I want to say that I have told you this in person, but when I talked to Stan Friedman, you know, several years ago, I said, who's the next Stan Friedman? And he didn't even hesitate. He mentioned your name. He said, and those are big shoes to fill. So
those are big shoes to fill. Yeah, it's such an honor for someone like him to say that. I don't know if I quite live up to that, but I do appreciate him him saying that for sure.
Yeah. Can you give I just mentioned you started, you know, doing this work at such a young age, and I think that is just amazing. And I'm hoping that more people that are, you know, young people do get involved in this. I'm a little worried about it when I go to some of the conferences. Is, you know, there's a lot of gray hair like mine out there.
Yeah. There's a lot more on my head too coming around. I blame the kids.
Yeah, right. That's right. So can you, tell the listening audience your background and
sure.
what got you started in this whole interest anyway?
Yeah, I wish I had a better story to tell other than I was just curious. Mm-hmm. I was 15 years old, and I was back in 1996. I was a sophomore in high school. And as a sophomore, you know, you're supposed to be studying in school and not writing letters to the government and researching UFOs. But I found myself fascinated by the UFO topic. Now, at the time, Google wasn't really a thing. Nowadays, we say, well, we're going to go Google something. Alta Vista was the search engine the day.
I remember.
And so those longtime internet users will remember that. And so I used Alta Vista search UFO. Even then, you would get hundreds of thousands of web pages. Now it's like 8 or 10 million.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's an incredible amount of information. So my curiosity was met with just a lot of stuff. And it's like, how do you make sense of it? We have that problem in 2019. But in 1996, I thought, okay, you know, what do we believe? What do we not believe? You'd read the same story but see different versions of it. And then it was like, well, who do you want to believe? And so I made kind of what I considered the stupidest decision of my life, but it turned out to be the best decision I ever made. And I honestly thought to myself at the age of 15 that if there was anybody or anything that was going to be honest about UFOs, it would be the United States government. And I thought that. And yeah. I learned about the Freedom of Information Act, and I thought, okay, let's just go after documents and see what's there. And that's what I did. I mean, I learned about the Freedom of Information Act, taught myself how to use it, filed a one request was my original back in 1996. It was for the 1976 Iran incident document.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Not something I claim to have found. This has been written about for many, many years prior to me. But I read about it and I thought, there's no way that this is real. There's absolutely no way. And so I filed that FOIA request and sure enough got the four-page document. Word for word, it was exactly what I had read it to be, which honestly looked like it came out of an X-Files episode, let alone a U.S. government agency. And so that was it. I was hooked. I mean, I literally started filing FOIA requests 5, 10, 20, even 40, 50 at a time, where I would just, you know, push them out there looking for documents.
Before we go on, can I just ask you?
Sure.
Because I hadn't heard about FOIA.
Yeah.
Well, like maybe 10 years ago or something, and not about UFOs, but something else. How did you know that at that age?
It was literally something I read on the internet, and it was the only document that they really had profiled was the 1976 Iran incident document. And they said, if you don't believe that this is legitimate, you can use this thing called the Freedom of Information Act.
I
thought, well, you know, what is that? I was like you. I'm like, I've never heard of that. But hey, if they're going to send me something for free, why not? And how the law is written, there is a lot you can get for free, but there's also a lot you might have to pay for. That's a long story in itself, but that's the nutshell. And so that was how I learned about it. And honestly, I was filing Freedom of Information Act requests before I really understood how to use it. Now, there's the basic fundamentals of it, and that's, you know, the in a nutshell, you request information, you should get it unless it fits into 9 exemption categories. Boom, boom, cut and dry. Unfortunately, it doesn't quite work that way, but that's the basic principle of it. So I was filing FOIA requests not really understanding the type of games that the government would play back. And as a 15-year-old kid, I had to learn very quickly that agencies like the CIA and the NSA and the FBI, they didn't want to hear from me, even though I was exercising my right. Mm-hmm. They wanted me to go away. And, you know, here we are 22 years later. I've collected about 2 million pages on the blackvault.com now, and it's something that I probably won't stop anytime soon.
Wow. You know, I was just talking during the monologue how you know, this show costs me money, you know, with bandwidth, you know, just from people listening to my podcast. So this, your website has to cost you money with all that information stored.
It's a lot. The website itself is, I've got it across a couple dedicated servers that are just for Black Vault.
Wow.
Yeah, and there's quite a few hundred gigabytes of data alone. The bandwidth is in the terabytes that gets downloaded every month. The unique people, like the unique visitors, not hits, because people overinflate hits, but the actual people that sit down and log on to the Black Vault is about 15,000 to 20,000 people every 24 hours.
Amazing.
You know, they generate literally 500,000 to 1 million hits per day on the web server. So it is an incredibly busy box of people downloading not only UFO information, but I mean, you name a government secret, I've probably gone after it in one way or the other.
Yeah. Does the space support itself? I mean, with all that?
Sadly, there's not a whole lot of money in giving information away. The site is free, and I'm proud of that, you know, it doesn't cost you a thing. As with most internet websites, there's advertisements, but sadly, you don't make a whole lot of money from that.
Yeah.
If the industry was the same as it was 20 years ago, I'd be retired. But the industry is not the same anymore. And what I mean by that is advertising on the internet was a lot more beneficial 20 years ago for people that had a lot of web traffic. But for every – and this is pretty much accurate. For every dollar you would make 20 years ago, you're lucky if you make a tenth of a penny now, literally. I mean, it is drastically different. So very, very little.
Yeah, but so this is a work of passion. There's no other – there's no other word for it that I can think of, because you're definitely not doing it to make money, and it's such a great service to have this out there. And I want to personally thank you for, you know, letting these things be available, and You know, and it's funny, I understand that also a lot of times people will stumble on your site and think that this is fresh and new and, you know, things that have been out for a long, long time, but you have stored them on this in this database. It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I appreciate that.
I was reading in your book where you said that you had some information. I think it was like 1,000 pages or something that all of a sudden it went viral and you didn't expect it to happen. And then you were on the Today Show and a few other shows, things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Things happen all the time that are just unexpected. I mean, even last December, I got not a UFO story, but it was documents that I literally fought years for. When it came to getting them under the Freedom of Information Act. And it really showed me the lengths that government agencies will go to, and this specific case was the CIA, to hide information. And what I've learned in 22 years is you have to look at how they deal with other topics to kind of understand UFOs and vice versa. And you can learn a lot as you intermingle your research in multiple topics versus just focusing on one. Because it's very easy to kind of fall into a pigeonhole of just assuming that you know what they're going to do about a particular topic. For me, I try and learn on how the different government agencies, and again, specifically the CIA in this example, operate. And in this particular one, they literally bold-faced told me something that was not true. I have it in writing. I have it on the telephone. I didn't record it, but I'm not allowed in the state of California. So for the CIA guys that are listening, I didn't record it. But it is in writing where they would tell me one thing, and the documentation totally proved another. And for me, at the end of the day, it showed me that they were trying to make me go away.
Yep.
They never thought that I would raise money in the tune of $400 or $500. Doesn't sound like a lot, but it adds up with the Freedom of Information Act, sure, when you're doing, you know, thousands of requests.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think they thought it would get the popularity that it did. And Newsweek covered it. Vice News covered it. Before I ever even got the documents, they saw what the CIA was doing about mind control. And I crowdfunded the entire amount in like 48 hours. Amazing. And wrote them the check. And they continued playing games for months and months. But I finally got the documents last late November, early December, and posted them all. And it's amazing to see. But I think it's an important thing to look at, again, to understand the lengths that these intelligence agencies, these government agencies will go to cover up things.
Right. Well, we're right at our break. So everyone that's listening, please hang in there. We'll be right back right after these messages. All right. Welcome back. My guest is John Greenwald Jr. And we just left off. He was talking about the government actually did a bold-faced lie. And the documents he was talking about was mind control. But, John, so when I was reading your book, and part in there that I got kind of a kick out of, you have a lot of evidence. I think you wrote somewhere in there, you have a lot of evidence the government does lie.
Yeah.
And with all these documents, are you seeing this, like, is this their MO? I mean, does it happen repeatedly?
Sadly, it happens repeatedly. For many years, I did try and stay away from the L word. I tried to stop making the accusation that, hey, the government is lying to you. You know, mm-hmm. Don't listen to them. And I don't want to start doing that now. But what I will say is you can't not say that. They are obviously misleading, and I think even by their own admission, Roswell is a prime example of that. And when you look at the different stories that have come out, it's clear that they were trying to give a false narrative to the general public. Mm-hmm. And they changed their story not once, not twice, not three times, but actually four different times on various versions of their story, all the way through their Project Mogul and test dummies and so on and so forth. For me, that to me shows that there is it malicious? I'm not sure, but there is an intent to mislead the public just with the basic fundamentals of the UFO topic. And those basic fundamentals are including of Roswell in those early days of Project Blue Book and what happened. So even though I don't want to say again they're lying to you, you can't get away from the fact there is something going on here, that they have been caught misleading the public. And to be honest with you, their current explanations, and this was the intent in the beginning of the book, the intent was to mislead the public, but the versions that they were using did not make sense. They did not hold up. You can fact check even their latest version, and it is full of holes.
Right.
They're better served to just let it go.
Right.
Stop talking about it. Let kooky people like me try and research it, but stop trying to add to the story, because by them doing that, in my opinion, it adds so much more mud to the water, but on the side that they are absolutely lying and that there is much more to just the Roswell story than they want us to know. We can assume that, but when you look at the actual evidence, you can put it in hardcore writing. That's exactly what's going on. They're trying to mislead. What exactly are they misleading about? I'm not real sure, but in the book, I try to show you, hey, look, some of these most plausible explanations, they can't be true.
Yeah, you know, I've said this a number of times, probably times on the show. Maybe the listeners might get sick of me saying it, but if nothing happened at Roswell, first of all, for the Army Air Force to say that they found a crashed disc, all they had to do was say nothing, never say anything about it at all. And I think that is that's a big puzzle to me, why they even came out with that in the first place. I mean, it doesn't really make any sense. Only a handful of people knew about it. And I just don't know why they even came out with it to begin with.
I think that they had to address it in fairness. I mean, in 1947, you have to think about the time frame where post-World War II, only by a couple of years, there was a lot of fear that there were foreign threats that could potentially reach U.S. soil. There was a lot of fear and panic about what the UFO situation, whatever it was, really was. So we needed to address it as a country. I think, though, by an attempt of doing that, when they, quote-unquote, got a flying saucer crashed in Roswell, they put their foot in their mouth, because all of a sudden, people were starting to realize this was not the right story. Things were fishy. Flying saucers reported crash. Then days later, no, it's a weather balloon. Then many, many years later, no, it's a top-secret Project Mogul balloon. The aliens that so many people had come forward seeing, the bodies and this and that, they explain by crash test dummies. I don't want to give the illusion that the whole book is about Roswell. I only do it in the beginning of the book, but it's to show that how ludicrous the explanation is, and how they address the bodies were a couple different ways. They said that they were crashed Air Force test dummies that they were using to test parachute systems, and also two aircraft accidents in which multiple Air Force pilots were either injured or killed. But the problem was is that Roswell happened in 47. The earliest crash test dummy was not invented until 1949 by Alderson Research Labs. That was the earliest one that I could ever find, and that is documented as being the first. Then those Air Force incidents in which pilots were used to explain the quote-unquote alien bodies were both 9 and 12 years after Roswell happened. So it's like, how do you have these time-traveling crash test dummies and time-traveling aircraft, you know, Air Force aircraft that traveled back in time, crashed, that's what people saw. The government essentially was saying that the witnesses had their dates wrong, but this was the explanation. So what I call all of that is the company line in the book, and I revert back to that throughout the entire book from cover to cover as the company line, because this is what the government wants you to believe. They address two things, the Roswell incident and then the UFO phenomenon as a whole. Roswell, they feel that they've explained, but I think we can kind of determine that their current explanation's fairly bunk. But then they try to explain the UFO phenomenon as a whole. And by doing that, they bring up Project Blue Book, 12,618 cases that they investigated. Only 701 remained unidentified, and the only reason those were unidentified was lack of evidence. So what I do in the book is then destroy that, is that I go in and show the fact that Project Blue Book was not an investigation, and there's a lot of evidence to support multiple different angles on why Blue Book was not a real investigation. But I essentially destroy that also, and all I use is their own documents. I don't use any whistleblower testimony, no leaked documents, no, I have a gut feeling that this is true, nothing. All I do is use exactly what they gave me under the Freedom of Information Act to destroy that company line. And the rest of the book, I get away from that, and just focus in on the reality of what is the UFO phenomenon using their own documents. And to be honest with you, even when I started this 22 years ago, I never thought I would amass the amount of information that I have. But doing the book allowed me to really concentrate and bring it all together and look at documents that I had not seen for, you know, years and years, to look at them again and see how damning the evidence really is when it comes to proving a cover-up, but then also showing the UFO phenomenon is very real. And then on top of all of that, how it's not as easily explainable as many skeptics want us to believe.
Right, right. Now, I heard you say on another show that the longest you have waited for a FOIA request was 14 years, which is amazing. So I want to just ask you, do you have to keep following up, or do you put in the requests and time goes by and all of a sudden one day you forgot all about it, but it pops in the mail? Well, how does that work?
Kind of both. Do you have to keep on top of it? Technically, no. Once you're in the system, they should respond to you. My record was 14 and a half years, as you noted, and that's a long time to wait. I wrote an article when I got the document finally, not based on what the document was about, but what happened on the planet in the 14 and a half years that I waited for that document to come.
Yeah.
And it was just more of a humorous look at how long they make you wait. And that's part of the game, in my opinion, that I think that they want people to lose interest, which I'm sure a lot of people do. The Freedom of Information Act is mainly utilized by journalists. So if you're, and I say mainly, I mean, I don't know what the exact percentages are, but if you're writing a story or an expose on UFOs and you file FOIA requests, you have a deadline, and your deadline is not 14 and a half years to the future. So a lot of times then the documents become irrelevant. So it's all part of the game, sadly. They want people to go away. They want people to lose interest. They've had a growing knack of, after a couple years, instead of you checking in with them, they will check in with you. And they will say, okay, Martin, are you still interested in this document? Because it's been 3 years since you've requested it. If we don't hear from you in 30 days, we're just going to go ahead and close your case. So then you're forced to stay on top of it. Now, they're not actually legally able to do that. They're actually fighting it in the courts. And I believe that they've actually already won, that government agencies are not allowed to do it, but they still do it. And in fact, one I posted on Twitter this week was where they 3 years ago asked me if I was still interested in the document. They wrote that about 2 or 3 years after I originally filed the request. Fast forward another 3 years to this week, they did the exact same thing. Are you still interested? So now I'm like 6 years or so in to waiting for this document to come, and they keep asking. And honestly, I mean, I hate to be morbid about it, but it's like they just want you to go away and die, you know? Like they're just waiting for that day that John Greenwald's not around anymore to answer this. And that's sad, not to be morbid, but I mean, it's humorous, but not. It's like, why wait this long? Stop spending the effort trying to see if I'm still interested and just process it. And my responses are always the same to these agencies. I never lose interest in any of my requests. And I'm interested because, you know, I filed a request. I'm not going to lose the interest, so please process it accordingly. And they still do it. Same exact request. A couple years go by, they'll try it again. And, you know, thankfully, I'm still alive at this point. Knock on wood.
Yeah.
But yeah, as I get older, and not, again, not to be morbid, but as I get older, there will become an age where I file a FOIA request and go, I wonder if I am going to be alive by the time that they respond to this thing. Because if you're waiting a decade and a half, a lot can happen in a decade and a half. And even though it's morbid to think about, it's all part of the game that they want to play.
Isn't that something? Now, because of that, because of what you do, do you think you're on any type of, I know this sounds a little conspiratorial, but do you think you're on any type of watch list of any kind? Or, you know, they're just paying attention to you because of what you're asking for?
I'm not sure how. The official answer is no. According to the government, I have filed a FOIA request to the FBI for my own file. It was one of the quickest responses I ever got. They said there's nothing there. Maybe other agencies are paying attention and investigating. Who knows? But for me, I think that I struggle with thinking about this. Is it scarier that I'm doing what I'm doing for 22 years, starting as a teenager, posting millions of documents on the internet for everyone to download around the world for free, and they're looking into that because they're scared? Or what's scarier, I'm doing all that and that they aren't looking into me, that they aren't caring about what I'm doing? So part of me is I hope they do care to a point. I'm not a Julian Assange. I don't take government documents in a dark alley and post them for the world to see. That's not my MO. But I would hope that they're concerned about that, and I would welcome that scrutiny. I'm not concerned about it at all. I got nothing to hide, and I do what I do legally, and I do it respectfully as I can anyway.
Now, would you, you know, this is kind of a question you probably shouldn't ask this early into the show, but do you have, out of those 2 million documents, do you have, I don't want to say smoking gun, but close to smoking gun records that you found like really, really compelling when you got them in the mail?
I think that the smoking gun for me is the overall picture. It's the overall way that the United States government deals with the issue. I think it's the overall way they deny interest in the issue. That the government documents completely contradict what I call, again, that company line. To me, that is more of the smoking gun. But one of the things that I talk about briefly in the book is, what is your definition of a smoking gun? And one thing that I've learned in 22 years, and I have a lot of fun doing shows like this and speaking to the public, is everybody has their own definition of what a smoking gun is. Mm-hmm. For some people, it is the documents and the overall arc of the story and how the government deals with it. Other times, people want the smoking gun that says, we have alien bodies, period. And then that's it. And that's the smoking gun. For others, it's just testimony. You know, evidence be darned. It's so-and-so XYZ says ABC, and that's enough for them. So I've learned that the smoking gun is very, very different for everybody. So not to be long-winded with you, but just to kind of give a background on what I feel about what that smoking gun is. But I feel that there are a lot of documents that drive home the lengths of how far the government will go to. One of my personal favorites is Air Force Manual 10-206. Mm-hmm. And what this was a find that I made back in about 2000, 2001 on accident, researching present-day UFO reporting procedures. And what I was amazed at was that hidden in plain sight was this Air Force Manual 10-206, an unclassified document that instructed all Air Force pilots to report UFOs as they see them, and that the following this manual was mandatory. So this wasn't a, well, if you feel like it's important. No, it was said verbatim, compliance with this regulation is mandatory. And so that meant that it was a very serious topic. Chapter 5 was devoted to the UFO topic. Now, I had reported this, you know, on my website, on theblackvault.com, but also through History Channel. I do a lot of work in television as a producer and writer. And we worked it into, I believe, two total History Channel documentaries. It was a very important part of those stories. But I didn't feel that it got the spotlight it deserved, because in there, and there's a lot of speculation out there on whether or not the government has hidden for many years UFOs or unidentified flying objects as an acronym, that they shield it under something else. Well, this was proof that they don't do that. It said unidentified flying objects, black and white. There was no hiding anything. And so when the Huffington Post, namely Lee Spiegel, who was working for them at the time, he had contacted me about doing a story on the top five best documents that I had received about UFOs. This was one of five that I had given him. I think it stuck out to him because it was irrefutable. It showed that the government agency that was leading the company line, I mean, they literally created the company line, that they said they had no interest in UFOs. They have a reporting procedure on reporting UFOs, right? Like, you can't get any more ridiculous than that. Mm-hmm. As a contradiction. And so he called the Pentagon for some type of a response. He left a message. He didn't get one. Well, journalists have deadlines. And I remember, fast forward the story a few days, he called me late on a Friday night. I was visiting my sister, and he calls me on the telephone. He says, John, you're not going to believe this. And I said, what? And he says, Air Force Manual 10-206, Chapter 5. I said, yeah. He says, it's gone.
Yeah.
I said, what are you talking about? And he had, I had showed him how to download it on the internet. Because when I had discovered it in 2000, it was not online. Through the years it had gone online, another key point of this, it was revised many years, and I am able to prove that it's documented, but UFOs never came out. When Huffington Post and Lee Spiegel was making phone calls, I said, look, you could take my word for it, but let me show you an Air Force site to download this from. That's what he was using. And when he goes to fact check something, goes to download it, Chapter 5 was rewritten, completely gone,
yep.
And it had something to do with now hurricanes. And so when he called me, I just thought, I mean, I love Lee. I've been friends with him for years, so yeah. I mean no disrespect. But I thought, you know what? He probably clicked on the wrong link. He didn't know where he was going or whatever, you know. And I got home, and, you know, I was amazed to see that they covered it up. They changed the manual. The revision date was about 48 hours or so after Lee's original phone call, which means that the minute a major mainstream media outlet was going to spotlight it and show this was irrefutable proof, they made it poof, go away.
That's right.
I call it the greatest trick of a magician. And it's like, look at my right hand so you don't know what the left hand is doing. And the left hand was trying very, very hard to get rid of the evidence. They did. Then Lee gets a call back, and apparently they tried to claim it was a coincidence or something like that. But for me, that showed irrefutable proof that, number one, they are interested in UFOs decades after Blue Book. But number two, they'll go to great lengths to cover it up. That the minute we were allowed to put this in front of the general public and go, see, this is something worthwhile, they just made it all go away and said, yeah, well, we weren't really interested in it, and so on and so forth. It was all a coincidence. We were planning on taking it away. And going back to my quick note about the fact that it was revised, why that is important is it shows that it was not a dead publication, that it was not forgotten about. It was actively revised through the years after me finding it, and UFOs was never taken out. And the reason why that's important is it shows that they had ample opportunity to do just that until someone was going to spotlight it in the major media, and then they made it go away.
Yeah, that's something. Well, to be fair to what you said earlier, Lee is rather technically challenged. I mean, he just graduated from a flip phone recently to an iPhone, and I hope he's listening. But yeah, he told me that. He told me that story, and I just thought that was amazing. I have actually on my website, I have that document, you know, that showed that. But yeah, that whole thing to me, I vaguely remember you being part of it. You're the one who actually found it, and yeah, that is a great document. Are there some other? We're going to break in about 5 minutes here. Are there some other really compelling situations like that, or as far as them trying to vanish something, or does it all just eventually trickle out, you know, the unclassified stuff?
Yeah, no, they're in a indirect way, I would say it's very similar. Under the Freedom of Information Act, there's a thing called mandatory declassification review. Now, I bring this up just to give a quick context that under the Freedom of Information Act, let's say you requested something in 1990. They release a blacked out version. If for the next 20 years people are requesting that same document through the Freedom of Information Act, they will release that original 1990 version with all the redactions until someone requests a mandatory declassification review. The minute that happens, they have to go back and re-review the information that they blacked out. Now, this is important because what's classified in 1990 is not necessarily classified in 2015 or 2019. So what I did was I collected all the UFO documents from all the big intelligence agencies. Then I went back and requested mandatory declassification reviews on what I had received years prior, which means they have to go back and re-review all that blacked out material. There is a lot you can read in these documents, but there's a lot you can't. It's classified all the way through to the top secret level. It's considered highly classified. And two agencies I'll bring up here, the National Security Agency and the Defense Intelligence Agency. The reason why I bring those up is that their UFO documents span well into the 2000s and again show a very high level of classification, including top secret. So I requested a mandatory declassification review from, we'll deal with the NSA first. they have, off the top of my head, maybe 300 or 400 or so documents, mostly what are called comment reports, C-O-M-I-N-T, or communications intelligence. They talk about UFOs, but the majority of them are blacked out. You can only read like 4, 5, 6 words on the entire page. Doing an MDR makes them go back and re-review it. Wouldn't you know that the NSA, after they processed my request, took like 2 years, if I remember, they could not find a single document that dealt with UFOs that they had released years prior that was not blacked out. According to them, they blacked out the originals, or in their case, they whited it out. It makes it a lot less sinister looking. Mm-hmm. And shredded the originals, or lost the originals, or got rid of them, or, you know, fill in the blank, but they didn't have them anymore. So for me, it wasn't the lie and the cover-up, it was an oops. It was, we don't have these anymore because we made a pretty big blunder, and all of these documents are gone. They said that they did find what's called the Yates Affidavit, which is the court, top secret court affidavit that was given during the Citizens Against UFO Secrecy v. NSA court case in the late 1970s, early 1980s, where under the Freedom of Information Act, they were trying to get those comment reports out. They did find that, and they gave me a less redacted version. But sadly, they claim that they lost all of those UFO documents. The Defense Intelligence Agency did the exact same thing. They claim that they lost all of their UFO information and can't find it. Now, the likelihood of a intelligence agency like the NSA, especially in the digital age, to just lose all that information, you know, a lot of it's been digitized. It doesn't matter if it was written before computers and scanners existed or that they were being utilized. A lot of that information's been digitized. For them to say that they lost it, the chances of that are pretty nil. Add in a second intelligence agency, in my opinion, that's a blatant cover-up. It's a blatant attempt to get people like me to go away, because now there is nothing that I can do to fight for those UFO documents, because now their official line is that they are 100% destroyed.
Now, I remember reading in your book, we have just like a minute and a half here, reading in your book where you had received a no such documents, they don't exist and all that, and then the very same person that said that to you actually released a whole bunch of UFO documents.
Yeah. Ironically, I read about it in UFO Magazine, Bill Burns' publication. I was writing for him at the time. And the quick summary of the story is I requested UFO documents from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. They claim we have nothing. It got transferred over to the National Archives. All of that fits into their company line that everything is at the National Archives. Also another point that's not true. And then years later, about 1,000 pages mysteriously appeared. And I read an article, and the spokesperson that was quoted was the same guy that actually signed the original denial letter a couple years prior. Now, was it an oversight? Was it a mistake? All of that is possible, but sadly, that's not how the Freedom of Information Act works. If they say they do a search, they need to by under the law. If they're just doing it, you know, haphazardly, and they're not doing a complete search, that's a problem in itself.
Right. Okay. We're at break. My guest is John Greenwald, Jr., and we'll be right back right after these minutes. All right. Welcome back. I'm Martin Willis with Podcast UFO, and my guest is John Greenwald, Jr. John, I'm going to open up the lines for anyone that would like to call in. That number will be up on the screen, and for those of you over at KGRA Radio, that number is 603-967-4030. That number is only live during the show only. I get people calling it all the time. It's a Skype number, so we can take calls if someone would like to call in. So as far as, I think we got someone already. It looks like we do. Hold on. Caller, your first name and where are you calling from?
My name is Dave Altman. How are you doing, Martin?
Hi, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing good. Hey, John. How are you doing?
Hi, Dave. I'm good. How are you?
Hey, so I don't know if you remember, but I work with David O'Leary from Project Blue Book.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And yeah, I was trying. I've been calling you for months trying to get those, see if you can get those pages for me.
What pages are you talking about?
We were looking to get maybe a couple of the actual pages, well, obviously not the actual pages, but copies of some Blue Book pages.
Okay.
So are you soliciting this online, Dave?
No, that's okay. I'm sorry if I missed a message from you. So,
yeah, we had emailed back and forth. John D'Souza hooked us up.
Okay. I'll be more than happy to look. I mean, to be honest with you, though, the Blue Book stuff is fairly open source online. I know that there's a couple websites to get it from, but I'd be more than happy to send you a link if you want to.
Yeah, everywhere I went, I couldn't get them, and I talked to George Knapp and a bunch of other people, and everybody said, the guy you got to go to is John Greenwald.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah, we were at MegaCon, and during David's interview with George Knapp, he gave you a couple of shout-outs, and we were out in the lounge afterwards, and some guy ran up and said, hey, I'm talking to John Greenwald right now, and he wanted to say thanks for David giving a shout-out for Black Vault during the interview.
I heard about that, yeah.
I said to the guy, give me that phone right now. I want to talk to John about the Blue Book pages. And well, he goes, oh, it's just on Messenger. And I said, oh, okay, just tell him I said hi.
Yeah. No, I'm sorry if I missed something, but I'll be more than happy to point you the right direction. It's an interesting story, Martin. I don't know if you want me to get into it. I had all of the Blue Book stuff posted for a little bit.
From Mercier? Rob Mercier?
No. That was something different. Yeah, oh, okay. Which is a very cool story, and much cooler actually than this one. But the short of it is Ancestry.com tried to throw a copyright claim on the Project Blue Book documents.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a really bad debacle. And yeah. The only reason I bring that up is to say, you know, here on an open forum, I don't disseminate those documents because I was threatened to be sued.
That's right.
Which is such a ridiculous story. So I was forced to bring them down. I don't believe that they had any right to do it. But it's Ancestry.com. They got a lot more money than I do. And they tried to lay a copyright claim on them. The only evidence they had, by the way, is because I gave them a special thanks. And it wasn't Ancestry.com. It was a subsidiary they bought many, many years ago. The only reason I'm bringing that up is I don't have a lot of those documents. I would just have to point you to those websites that are online. But I will. I know your last name, so I'll search my email. And I'll make sure I didn't miss anything. Or if I did, I apologize. And then I'll drop you a line and, you know, see if I can help you out or at least point you in the right direction.
All right. If anyone else needs to get a hold of John, now is the time.
Yes.
We have another caller. Thanks for the call, Dave.
Did I?
You're welcome. And I was also calling to say hi to you, Martin. Don't worry. Don't be jealous.
I know. How catty. All right. All right, Dave. Thanks. We got another caller on the line.
Thanks, guys.
Caller, what's your first name? Where are you calling from?
Jim from British Columbia.
Oh, Jim.
Hey, Jim. I hope I didn't miss any of your messages.
I can barely hear you, Jim.
Hi.
If you can speak up a little bit.
Hi, Martin.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Yes, Martin, hi. I'm sorry for being a bad caller in the past. I'm going to try to be a good caller now, and I have a good question for John. John, I went to your site, and I searched for, very specifically, these handwritten pages done by the World War II pilots of their Foo Fighter sightings.
Okay.
I've seen a few of them, and they're excellent. Do you have those?
It doesn't sound familiar, though. It sounds like that might be more in the Project Blue Book collection, given the time frame, because most of that stuff wound up in the Project Blue Book collection, which is estimated to be anywhere from 60,000 to 80,000 pages at the National Archives. Those specifically don't ring a bell to me, though. So I'm not sure where to point you.
I've seen them. I saw them in a video, and I didn't take screen prints of them. I should have. There's about 10 pages that I read, and they're all Foo Fighter sightings in the daytime, handwritten by pen and ink on paper by these pilots, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the thing the thing is, these were daytime sightings, and that's exactly what I have seen myself, and they describe them perfectly and exactly the same as what I saw, right? And this is the value of it, really. And they're in their own handwriting with pen and ink, so you can judge the witness, you know, their writing style and all this. Really excellent. But yeah, I guess if you don't have that sort of thing.
I'll be honest with you, off the top of my head, doesn't sound familiar. If you found them on my site, I wouldn't be surprised either, because there's a lot. But there are a couple resources out there. I know, I don't know if they would have them, but you might want to Google Project 1947, Jan Aldrich's site. I know that he, I believe, focuses on quite a few of the documents from that era. I'm not sure if those would be official records that you're referencing or something that maybe was written up and collected by a researcher. So without screenshots, might be hard to determine. But you might want to start there and see what kind of documents you come up with.
Project 47?
Project 1947 is the website.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much.
Sure.
Bye.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for the call. So now I would like to ask you, I also saw... you were being interviewed in a video when you were talking about red flags of ATIP. And
yeah.
First of all, I always forget exactly what ATIP stands for, and because it's because
so
people confuse it for two different things. But
yeah.
But this is the purported government program to research unidentified, well, what they called aerial phenomena or something. What were the red when you went to research of this as much as you could? You said there were red flags, and what are some of those red flags?
Sure. Yeah. The quick context, and to answer your question about what ATIP stood for, it depends on what version of the story that you hear. The official line, anyway, is the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. The controversy for a while was it was reported by the media. And the Pentagon was saying Advanced Aviation Threat Identification Program. So some confusion about what the acronym was for. I was the one that came out with the Pentagon statement first, because they were the ones that I was able to get a hold of first. And so I'm kind of tied to that controversy that I was pushing one name over the other. I was just showing the contradiction, and I kind of think it got embellished in the internet blogosphere a little bit about what the debate really was about. The Defense Intelligence Agency, which is outside of the Pentagon, then told me it was the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. What's really funny is a lot of the attackers towards me were saying, well, the Pentagon is saying through a spokesperson and they don't know anything, so why would you believe them? Aerospace, that name came from a DIA spokesperson. When I came out with that, somebody else says, aha, see, I told you. It's like, well, wait a minute. Both of them are spokespeople. What are you trying to argue with? So it's a very kind of convoluted mess on what ATIP was really about. This is that New York Times, Politico, Washington Post, avalanche of publicity that the program got in December of 2017. And where I originally, I'm going to be honest with you, I was really super excited about it. I thought it was very cool. Anybody who knows me, sees me publicly, hears my talks, whatever, they know that I'm a big advocate for the fact that a cover-up is there. There's a lot of evidence for it. So when there was an active present-day UFO program, I mean, I was all over it. I started filing FOIA requests. I was working on a television show at the time. It was for a major network. I can't say it just because it actually still may go. So I can't really say it, but it was something we'd all recognize. And so I was working on development for it, and I was able to get access to the Pentagon Public Affairs Office. Almost immediately, they started denying that the media stories were not what was being done behind the scenes, that ATIP was something else altogether. So with that quick groundwork, that started the red flags, because on one hand, we were getting a story of what ATIP was and that the government / Pentagon approved Mr. Luis Elizondo speaking about it. But then when he starts speaking about it and he says, well, there's a UFO aspect to it, this is a secret Pentagon UFO study as the media touted it, the Pentagon's like, no, that's not it. The DIA said, no, that's not it, and was saying that it was embellished Now, we've talked about the government lies on your program here for the last hour, so I'm open to the government lying. What doesn't fit is everything else. As I started researching, not only with the government, but then what was being said publicly about ATIP, things started not to match up. And I would say the most controversial thing that I've published was a timeline. I know Alejandro Rojas talked about a timeline as well. A couple weeks ago, I had posted one that used all of the key players of ATIP. And this will encompass all of the red flags, or most of them. Not all of them, but most of them. And I only used on this timeline Mr. Luis Elizondo, Dr. Hal Putoff, who was also a key player in ATIP by his own admission, but also it's well known and not disputed, and the media that had direct access to Mr. Elizondo, Dr. Putoff, and to the STARS Academy. And I created this huge timeline, and it's a mess. And why I bring that up is that if everybody was out giving a truthful narrative, I'm not insinuating they're lying, but if everybody was just telling us a history, we wouldn't have such blatant contradictions. So my point was, let's take the government out of the equation and just focus on the public figureheads that were directly involved with ATIP and see what their story is. And it is near impossible. Actually, it is impossible to make a fluid timeline. Now, with respect to Alejandro Rojas, I don't want to take away from his work. He put together a timeline. What I was listening to in the beginning of your show was he only used Mr. Luis Elizondo. That's fine. If you only listen to one person, you can make a fluid timeline. The problem is that there were multiple people involved with the ATIP program, including Dr. Putoff and Senator Harry Reid, who I also used on the timeline, which I failed to mention. When you add in those other players, it's a mess. So if we're excluding them, why are we excluding them? They were directly involved and had a hand in it. So my role, I don't consider myself a journalist. I never have. I consider myself a researcher and an investigator. So for me to make sense of all of this, my whole point was, because it's not popular to go against, you know, the going story of the day, and I know that, but I'm not here to be popular. I'm here to be accurate. And I think a lot of people then go, oh, Greenwald's trying to, you know, take down whatever or go against so-and-so, or he's trying to insinuate, and that's not it. It's about getting to the root of what the story really is. And for me, when you look at what we are being told, it doesn't match up. And so that's kind of the nutshell. I can go into more specifics if you'd like, but that's really the nutshell of the red flags, is that the basic fundamentals of what ATIP is told to us is contradictory to what the key players are saying. But then another aspect that's not part of the timeline, but I'll give it in my answer, is that when you look at decades of history, when it comes to true UFO documents, true UFO programs, true UFO cases, nothing matches up. It's like a completely different type of story. So was it a UFO program? I don't know. I'm not saying it's not. I'm saying that evidence leads me to believe it probably wasn't.
Okay. Well, I do want to talk a little more about that in just a minute. Right now, we have another caller on the line, and I'll get right back to that after this call. Caller, your first name, where are you calling from?
This is Todd from Richmond.
Thank you for your patience. I know you've been hanging a long time. You have a question for our guest?
Yeah, it's a kind of a two-part question. One is, John, over the years since you've been doing this, what would you say is the most interesting document that you have gotten a response on regarding the UFO topic? And the second part of the question is, same thing, but like non-UFO related, say like MK Ultra or some other secret they're keeping.
Sure. It's always hard for me to pick one UFO document. I did talk about 10-206, so I won't repeat that. That is one of my favorites. I would also bring up as a big honorable mention that 1976 Iran incident document. It will always hold a special place in my heart. That's what got me interested in this. That's why I'm sitting in this chair talking with Martin and still involved. In a nutshell, the 76 Iran incident showed technology in 1976 that we really don't have today. And when you read that in a government document, that is extraordinary. I mean, a UFO turned into four separate UFOs, one of which they believe either landed on the ground or hovered directly above it. It shut down two F-4 Phantom jets, seemingly strategically. It is an amazing document. But here's what I'll pull up, because I invite everybody to read it. It's four pages. I can give you the URL. I have a page dedicated just for that case. But here's what's fascinating about that document, and it's something that I want everybody really, really to sit and think about. And the fact is that you see this extraordinary document, and it is unclassified. That is an extraordinary piece of evidence, because then when you add in the fact that the government has not 10, not 20, not a couple hundred, but literally thousands of UFO documents that are considered all the way up through top secret, that still to this day are considered classified, and they will not release the information. They will go to the lengths to say, oh, we lost it, or oops, we shredded it, or whatever. What's underneath that blacked out information, those black boxes? If you can read the 1976 Iran incident, and there's a lot more, but if you just focus in on that one document and the fact that they did not classify it, I don't know if that was a mistake or not. But think about what really could be classified top secret when it comes to the UFO phenomenon. And I think that that's a largely overlooked aspect to that document and to this whole field when it comes to government records, because there is extraordinary evidence to support not only the cover-up, but you don't have many definitions of what the UFO phenomenon really is until you start adding in an intelligent civilization. And that's what I actually end my book with, is kind of going into, I call it debunking the debunkers, where you deal with those plausible explanations of what UFOs are, what they could be, and really kind of try and drive home that that just can't be reality. So that being said, that's the UFO document. The other one, non-UFO related, also a very tough one. I would say, though, the MKUltra experiments, to me, are definitely top of the list. Just to kind of give you one specific example, actually two very quickly, from the thousands of documents that I got late last year that literally went viral on the internet when I published them. The biggest, I would say, documents that came out of that were twofold. One was a successful report about a successful attempt to implant chips into dogs, and they were successful in remote controlling the animals way back in the 1960s.
Wow.
With the CIA to be able to do that in the 1960s, that paved the way. They called this research behavioral modification. They did not connect it to MKUltra. Why that's important is that there is a whole slew of additional projects that I know now are there that did not deal with MKUltra and mind control and the LSD experiments that we know of. Behind the scenes, they were doing experiments, and successful ones at that, on animals. As far as I could tell, they made six remote-controlled dogs. They even have very poor photographs and diagrams, but they showed that they were actually able to make the dog, under their own commands, do what they wanted: turn left, turn right, go up, stop, sit, so on. And you look at that, and that the implications behind that from, what, 50, 60 years ago plus, is extraordinary. So when you add in the ability for them to do it with humans, that's frightening. The second document I'll bring up quickly is a one specific document has programs listed which do mention MKUltra and a couple other ones, but quite a few of them are blacked out. And what that means is that the CIA for years has publicly said, you guys know everything. We released everything. We did the congressional hearing many moons ago. It's all out on the table. That's our dirty laundry. Leave us alone. And yet this document proves that there are multiple project names with descriptions that are 100% classified that they don't want to tell us about. And why that's important is that, according to their own writing to me, they do not consider this material part of MKUltra, which means that there is a slew of additional material that probably has never seen the light of day that would scare the most devoted fans to Stephen King, because they are extraordinary with their implication, and the fact that they were successful putting chips into brains, it adds a whole new perspective to agencies like DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, that is doing research just like this in plain sight of implanting brains and connecting brains with artificial intelligence and artificial limbs. Tie that back to what they were doing 50, 60 years ago. The possibilities are endless on what they can do right now.
Absolutely.
So those would be a couple, I tried to make it quick, but a couple examples.
Yeah, great. Well, hey, thanks for the call.
Hey, thank you, Martin. Thanks for your work, John. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. So before the call, we were talking about ATIP and your thoughts on them. And I understand with the deep, research that you do and you look at history and the history of what you have seen over the years, and this is not apparently lining up. So the question, and it's speculation, but do you speculate that, well, who would Luis Elizondo be then in this case? A disinformation situation?
Yeah, and I don't make that speculation. I don't know, to be honest with you. And I mean, he seems like a very nice guy. He seems genuine.
Yep.
Do I want to say he's lying to you? No, because it's quite possible the government is lying. What's interesting, though, is what he is saying put on a timeline by itself, I believe, would still contradict each other, meaning just using that as a source. And I believe Mr. Alejandro Rojas, who did the timeline, primarily used him as a source, and that's okay. The problem is he is not just the only source out there. So now we have to ask ourselves, what is going on? Alejandro had mentioned 2007 as a start date. That completely contradicts everybody. And the reason I say that is, according to Mr. Elizondo, ATIP didn't start until 2008. The contracts that were posted publicly that anybody can access were not posted until August of 2008. So what was going on in 2007? The New York Times said ATIP started in 2007, and they saw the contracts to prove it. The problem is that contradicts their own source for the story, that it was OSAP, not ATIP, that started in 2000, or excuse me, it was OSAP, not ATIP, that started first, but not until 2008. If they saw contracts, it wouldn't have said ATIP. It didn't exist. So the question mark is, what did they see? So it's not me trying to pick on journalists or Mr. Elizondo or the government. It's not me doing that at all. It's showing there are blatant contradictions, sometimes as easy as a date or a name, other times like really important aspects to the story that just don't match up at all. So that to me is the red flag. It's like, well, why can't we just get a one side of the story? Again, it's not popular, and I get that, and I get a lot of heat for it, and I understand that because I'm a big advocate for the government is covering this up. So we just have to assume that the government is covering this up. The problem, though, is, again, you can take them out of the equation and you still have the majority of the red flags left over. Do they have easy explanations and answers? Possibly. I'm open to that. But you have to ask some really tough questions that I don't think people are asking right now. And, another really unpopular notion to this is Bigelow Aerospace and how he got the contract and what was the time frame that he got it. And that brings up a slew of other contradictions to the story that Senator Harry Reid actually on more than one occasion addressed, that this was not a sweetheart deal. It was posted in public, and that BASS was created specifically once they won the contract for ATIP, right? That sounds great. But if you actually go to the Nevada Secretary of State, BASS was actually created in January. The bid solicitation was not until August of that year in 2008. So either he had foreknowledge or he just miraculously thought, let's just create this LLC and hopefully one day there'll be some kind of research program that we can tie it to, or the reporting was wrong, right? Again, not me picking on anybody. It's we can't have it all ways. So for me as an investigator and someone who's very excited for this story, it just doesn't match up. And I will just add one more thing for the record is that I believe what we have been led to believe ATIP is the secret UFO study, I believe should exist. I fully support it. One thing I do in the book and do in public lectures and even today is that I try and show that there is a huge national security threat to this phenomena, whatever it is. I personally use the plural version. I believe there's multiple facets to the UFO phenomena. And I believe that there is a threat to national security that has started through the 40s and 50s, goes all the way to today. I believe that that is irrefutable. So I think something like ATIP as a UFO reporting program should exist. But my biggest fear, and I think that everybody who takes this topic seriously should have this fear, is that if it turns out that this was overly embellished or not what we are led to believe, the media has shifted with taking UFOs more seriously.
Mm-hmm.
If it comes out that this was an over-embellished story or not true, or I don't know what the end game is, but if it turns out that it's not what we have been led to believe and these red flags are legitimate and they don't have easy answers, the next time that important evidence shows itself that's irrefutable, the media is not going to take that gamble again, right? They don't want to be caught with pie on their face and running front page stories about something that ultimately wasn't true. That's my fear. And that's not me being trying to inject myself in the story. That's a fear that I think that the field should have and a concern that we should have. It's better to deal with these tough questions as a UFO community. I mean, it's called a community for a reason. Figure out what these red flag solutions are and then branch out. So when somebody else attacks us who really doesn't care about the UFO community, we have an answer lined up. But sadly, it's well over a year since we've learned about this program. We still don't have answers. And my intention with that timeline was to show these are the key players. These are the key outlets that have given you the information from the media based on these key players. And nothing matches up. And it's a mess. I call it a mess.
Well, I was very thankful that when the Roswell slides, so-called slides, came out, that they didn't get the media coverage. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
That would have been a real mess there, I'll tell you that. We have a caller. We have someone else trying to call in as well. Caller on the line, your first name, where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Andy from Stratford, Connecticut.
Hi, Andy. Thanks for your patience.
Hey,
you've been on for a while.
Sure. Yeah, my question kind of ties into John's last thoughts on the government revealing what they know. And it always makes me wonder, calling to mind the ATIP and the recent Tic Tac UFO, where the Navy is sort of condoning the release of the footage and acknowledging that something inexplicable happened.
Yeah.
How do you think that ties into the overall theme for the last few decades, which has been just cover-ups? It's all cover-up denial and misinformation. Are we seeing a change in their attitude going forward, in your opinion, or is it just a case of the right hand not knowing what the left hand's doing? And, I'll take your answer off there.
Thank you. Thanks for the call.
All right. Thanks, guys. Good show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a hard one to answer. And the if I understood you correctly, I mean, there's a couple things about the videos. First, let me say that when military pilots come forward with a story like Commander Fravor and those from the Nimitz, that's extraordinary. No one should bat an eye on that. If it was one person, then maybe we can scrutinize it. There's a lot of people that were involved in that have come forward, and I think it deserves a second look. In regards specifically to the video, and again, this is where I'm not sure if I understood it quite correctly on what you were asking, but it's important to note that the U.S. government's official stance is they never released those videos. According to the Stars Academy, those three videos were officially declassified and released. Obviously, that's a huge contradiction. We can paint a very solid, irrefutable timeline of the United States government and military lying about this topic. So I'm not opposed to the fact that they are just not being truthful. What concerns me is the fact that To the Stars Academy talks about what they call a chain of evidence document that supports that these were officially released and declassified. I don't want to speak for them, but I'm pretty sure that they have said in the past that they have those documents on their website. The last I looked, it said that those videos come with that documentation. The problem is they won't show it to you, and I want to know why. That's a big red flag for me. Do I have doubts that the videos are real? Not really. I would probably bet money that they are real. The question mark is why the secrecy from an organization wanting to end the secrecy? Mm-hmm. If they have those documents, they are not classified. That's not how security oaths work. When you sign an NDA or a security oath, you can't take classified information as a souvenir, right? You have to leave the classified information there, and you can't take it home with you. So I do not believe that it is classified at all if they have it. If they don't have it, the question mark is why. Why wouldn't they have any type of release record to show that an official video from a U.S. military jet is unclassified or declassified? There is a difference between declassified and unclassified. So there's a lot of clarification that's needed there that's never been addressed. Going back to your question, is there a change? It's hard to tell. I mean, if they're lying, then, well, the pattern continues. If they're being honest, this is something that a lot of people don't want to deal with. Even though we can prove a long history of the government lying, the reality is the government has actually been truthful more times than they lied. I know that's hard, that some people don't want to realize, but that is true. It's historically documented. So in that respect, how do we know when they're lying? We can't go to a place where we just assume, the military's lying to you, the government's lying. How do you know that they're lying? They're talking. You know, we can't go there. That's a very scary place to be in. We have to have some faith in those that we elect and those that, you know, are kind of handling the big picture, so to speak. So is there a change? I think not really, but I'm eager to see when the documents do get released about ATIP on what it really was. But on that note, I think the waters are so muddy that no matter what is released, I don't think those believers and supporters of To the Stars Academy and the fact that ATIP was a UFO program, if documents are released to show that it wasn't, they won't believe it anyway. I think the line in the sand has been drawn quite firmly. So no matter what comes out officially, it's just not going to be taken seriously. And that's a shame.
Wow. Yeah, I do want to talk a little bit more about those videos. By the way, I have some of the two latest people to come forward on the USS Nimitz case. They're coming up at the end of the month on the 30th on this show, so stay tuned for that. Omar and PJ are going to be on along with Dave Beatty. So we have another caller. We can kind of hear him in the background. Caller, where are you calling from? Your first name?
This is Joe.
Hi, Joe. Where are you calling from?
I'm in Sarasota, Florida.
Oh, beautiful place. I was there just a few weeks ago. Very nice area. So you got a question for our guest?
Well, first I want to say that both of you guys, I'm very impressed with what you do, and I'm very thankful for what you're doing, in particular with John. I'm really frustrated. I'm frustrated for John. And the frustration looks like this. All the big names in the UFO community, from Richard Dolan, Grant Cameron, Jimmy Church, you name it, go down the list of the top 10, the top 12. I think all of them and all of us, the larger community, are going to be in the same place a year or two from now when it comes to ATIP. Basically, all just looking at it and saying, calling it for what it is, which is, it's clearly an op. It's an operation. That was clear prior to the New York Times article. And let me explain why I say that. And I believe that John understands why I say that, but let me clarify it. We heard Tom DeLonge for months before October 2017 telling us how many meetings he had in vacuum-sealed quiet rooms with Defense Intelligence and Pentagon operators. We heard him virtually every other week on a different show telling us about those meetings. This is 6 months before Luis Elizondo went through his process of feigning, quitting, feigning retirement, whatever that was. Point being, you know, that list of 10 people, that certainly includes both of you guys, Alejandro. We're all going to be in the same place a year or two from now. We all can see it. We're going to look back at this and say that this was just an operation, another operation. So what I'd like to see, and I think John is really at the forefront of this, but I don't see why everyone else isn't lining up to be in the same position that John is right now. And there are a couple that are getting there, like Jimmy Church is getting close to being fed up with Luis Elizondo's story, and there are others. But it seems that enough, to me, enough time has passed that all the major players looking at this should be to that point. Let me add one other thing that you just mentioned, Martin, that leads me to that conclusion about the Nimitz people coming out. When have you ever seen anything like this with half a dozen to a dozen guys from half a dozen different shifts on an operation being freely speaking about this one particular incident? When have you ever seen anything like that? Okay, go ahead, John.
No, on your last point, yeah, I think that the Nimitz case, again, reinforcing what I already said, is something to look into. I think at the end of the day, I wish it wasn't so connected with to the Stars Academy and quote unquote that the ATIP story, just because I believe it deserves to stand on its own, and I believe that the public should definitely look at it. In regards to the UFO community as a whole, I don't want to name names, but I also don't want to say that everybody is just hoorah TTSA and ATIP and this is it, proof of disclosure and this and that. I think that there are a lot of people that are asking important questions. I'm just loud about it, you know. And the reason why I'm loud about it is I do fear again that repercussion if it does turn out to be something that it's not. But the other part of me is that this goes to the core of the basic fundamentals of what research and investigation really is. And again, I'm not picking on journalists, but I have been known to say here in the last month and have caught some heat for it, is that there's a journalistic standard that, in my opinion, has gone out the window when it comes to reporting on ATIP. Now, that's not me basing in an opinion. That's me stating a fact. And why I say that is if you look at the timeline with the sources of the key players involved, journalists should be asking, why does Dr. Helpotoff say one thing, Mr. Elizondo says another? Why is that? Why are these discrepancies as reported by the media, why do they exist? And no one is asking those questions. The 2007 versus 2008 start date, that sounds irrelevant probably to some people. But to an investigator trying to piece together the puzzle, that becomes incredibly important. It becomes incredibly important because it ties in to the private contractor that got the bid. It ties into how much foreknowledge was there for them to bid on it. Here's another tidbit that is officially documented that at this point is not disputed, and that is the fact that there was only one bidder on the OSAP contract when it was posted. Only one. Now, we know OSAP led into ATIP. So that is important because in this day and age, even in 2008, when the bid solicitation was posted,
Just hold that thought just one second. So when people call into the show, make sure you mute your computer or whatever it is. We have a caller that just called in. Please mute. And sorry about that, John. Continue.
No, that's okay. But it becomes crucial to understanding, you know, that part of the story with the government contractor and how he got the bid. In 2008, in the corporate environment, even then, it's incredibly cutthroat for government contracts because you're talking about millions and millions of dollars. As reported by the New York Times, it was $22 million. As reported by George Knapp at KLAS, it started at $10 million. We don't know if there was an additional $12 million. but he showed a screenshot of $10 million. So we're talking about millions and millions of dollars, bottom line. How could there only be one bidder? Like, that doesn't make sense to me at all. Like,
yeah, the sweetheart deal, that, like you said.
Well, maybe. I don't want to make the accusation, but we have to look at that. As and again, I'm beating a dead horse, but as a researcher, you have to take all of the possibilities, then look at the evidence, and start scratching them off the list. If you go into researching something or reporting on something, either way, and you have a bottom line conclusion already, or you go in with a slant that, well, ATIP's a UFO reporting program, what evidence do we have? We have Mr. Elizondo. That's fine. That's a great source. The problem is he contradicts himself. That's not me being mean about it. That's me using what he has said and putting it on a timeline, and it's contradictory. When you look at all of that in the bigger picture, I go back to that journalistic standard that has gone out the window. We need to push those hard questions to answer these red flags. They may have easy answers. I have tried to stress that a million times. I have tried to reach out to Mr. Elizondo officially. To the Stars Academy, won't let me talk to him.
Yeah.
It was over 4 months that I had reached out and getting kind of the brush off, so to speak, and they finally said no. I question whether or not they want the tough questions, whether they want to address some of these things, because it's not going to be classified, plain and simple. I do not believe that the red flags that I have brought up are classified. I know you have a caller, Martin, but I do, before the end, want to address what people have largely called as FOIA exempt, which is also what Mr. Elizondo has said as a, I'll call it an excuse on why we won't see the important information. I definitely think that that deserves a little bit of time, but I know you got a caller, so I don't want to keep you from it.
No, we'll just go back to that. Thank you, caller, and we do have a new caller on the line. Where are you calling from? And your name, please, first name.
Are you talking to me?
I'm talking to you.
Okay, that's great. This is Barbara. I'm in West Hollywood, California, and I'm loving listening to your program, and I have a kind of a dumb question. I've never tried to get a FOIA document, but I'm always amazed at, well, the government says this, or the government says that. So I'm curious, when you call in for a FOIA request, or you email for a FOIA request, do you ever talk to a human being, or is it always a robot? Do you ever have conversations with human beings?
Yeah.
Because it seems to me we're robotic.
That's a great question to ask. Yeah, so the basic principles of the Freedom of Information Act is you do request in writing. It depends on the agency. Some are via email, some are postal mail, some are online. After the case has been created, most agencies have a FOIA team. Sometimes they're very small teams, other times they're a little bit larger, but there are humans. And it's a great question that you bring up, and it's a point that I always like making because a lot of people forget that, yes, the big, bad, evil government that lies to you all the time, there are humans behind it. They are trying to do the best that they can do, that sometimes it's not necessarily a cover-up or intentional misleading of the public. Sometimes it's just downright to a human error. There is problems that come along with it, but that's a different discussion. So I've always tried to maintain a relationship, a friendship even, because I do sympathize with everything that they have to deal with. But to go back to your question, yeah, you do talk to people. There are humans on the other side. And most of the time, they're very interested in helping you, that they're not just, Barbara, you got to go away. Go back to North or West Hollywood. You know, it's not about that. It's about that they want to do their job and do it right. And sometimes they have questions. They'll pick up the phone. They'll call me. They'll call you, whatever it is. And they're just humans, just like you, me, and Martin. And that's what I always like to point out. Sometimes they're not so nice. And that is not fun to have to deal with certain agencies when they have people that are very annoyed when they see John Greenwald pop up in their mailbox. So there are bad times. But yeah, there's humans on the other side, and there's a lot of human interaction. To close the thought, though, I will say sometimes with some agencies, it is like you're talking to a robot that cannot think for itself. And you get these form letter responses, not all the time, but sometimes. And you just want to pull your hair out. You really do.
Yeah, I don't have much.
That's That's great. Thank you so much. I'm really shocked that you actually have conversations with human beings about this.
No, I appreciate the question.
Is this Barbara H., your last name?
Yes, it is.
Hi, Barbara. We communicate via email. All right. I have a bunch of people trying to call in, so thank you so much for the call.
I'll hang up.
All right,
bye-bye.
Thanks. All right. We have a new caller on the line. Your first name and where are you calling from? Caller?
Yeah, this is Adam from New York.
Hi, Adam. How are you?
Hey, Adam.
Hi, how you doing?
Got a question for our guest?
Yeah, I did have a question. I heard you guys talking about TTSA, and I don't want to relate this back to the 2017 December New York Times, Politico, and Washington Post, I believe it was, articles again. But I just wanted to ask John while he was on the phone. I was speaking with my lawyer over the weekend doing some work at his house. I come to realize how many people don't know about this story, and I was talking to him about it, and he looked at me like I had three heads. Now, in the story itself, it didn't say anything extravagant. It's talking about $22 million fundage for this program by Harry Reid for the government to look into these things. And I explained to him, you know, from his standpoint of a regular person not interested in this topic, is this all just disinformation or misinformation? I know this might be a generic question, but I'm just looking at it as from the point of I've posted this topic many times, and I've tried to kind of get it some traction to see if to get more regular people looking into the subject. And that's all I'll say. I'm just wondering if it's disinformation and why it's not really garnering the greater interest of the public in general, it seems. Or maybe I'm wrong, and maybe that's just what I'm seeing from my sphere of influence. But for me, it seems like it should be a bigger story. And with that, I'll let you guys go. I'll stay on the line and see what he thinks about that.
Yeah, I appreciate the question. It's hard for me to pinpoint what the conclusion is, meaning what is the intent here? Is it disinformation? Is it just people that are a little bit careless with the facts? Is this embellishment? I really don't know. I think it deserves a lot more attention, and I think that it deserves addressing, not only because I'm being noisy about it and want to know, but I think the UFO community and I think the general public deserves to know. Why your attorney probably hasn't heard about it is we're well over a year now. The New York Times front page story, it was an amazing show of attention worldwide, right? There's no doubt about it in December of 2017 that there was a ton of publicity. What has happened since then? In my opinion, not much. And I think that in the grander course of trying to educate the public on this is ATIP, it was a secret Pentagon UFO study. There's a lot of stuff that we need to push and let's get answers. I know that takes time, but I think that you need to hold on to that public interest, that you need to continue to come out. It's a whole show in itself, but I'm not sure if a History Channel show is the right answer. Because you're taking away from the newsworthy aspect and putting it onto a network show more known for reality-type UFO programs. Now, I want to say up front, I am a television producer. I have worked for A&E Networks quite a bit. I have produced on History Channel. I have no negative feelings about this. This is entertainment. And I think with that, I'll say it again. It's entertainment. You take away from the newsworthy aspect of it, and you're putting it on a network that's interested in entertainment. And I think that is probably not the right approach. So now what happened as a result? Well, we haven't heard much of anything because they're planning this television show on the History Channel. Well, not everybody has the History Channel.
That's right.
Not everybody cares to watch the History Channel.
Exactly.
And on top of that, it doesn't go worldwide like it does in December of 2017 on the History Channel.
Exactly.
So all of that is a problematic approach to something that should be more newsworthy, to where your lawyer says, oh, yeah, I saw CNN or Fox News or MSNBC do a story, doing a follow-up story last Friday. Yeah, no, that's really cool of XYZ, but we're not seeing that. You know, we're seeing very minimal coverage now.
And I just wanted to add, too, the thing about my lawyer is he's an ex-Marine, and he actually had some clearances he was involved in intelligence, and that's why I wanted to get his reaction on it, because he is ex-military. He was in the Marines. I'm not sure. I have to check his rank, but I know he's pretty high up. I know he ended up doing some intelligence stuff there. That's why I wanted to see his reaction on it. You know what I mean? I thought it would be interesting. And he, you know, he said, you know, I think there's some stuff going on, but other than that, he didn't really seem that I couldn't catch his interest. I just want to thank you for all your work, and I've got to go on your site sometime and dig through all the stuff. I appreciate all the work you do, and thank you very much, Martin, for your show. You guys have both put in a lot of work, and I appreciate it very much.
Thank you. John, so we have this is the last phone call I'm going to take.
Sure.
That caller is on the line. Thanks again, Adam. Caller, your first name, and where are you calling from?
Stephen from Oregon. Can you hear me okay?
Hi, Stephen. Yes, thank you for the call. You have a question?
Yeah, just a quick one. John said something I've never heard before a minute ago. He said DOD denied releasing those videos, or the government denied releasing the videos.
Yes, sir.
And I have never heard that before. Could you just dig into that a little bit and
Absolutely.
How you figured that out?
Yeah. So I work directly with the Public Affairs Office at the Pentagon, specifically the Department of Defense, through the Office of the Secretary of Defense. I was told by a major, her rank was Major Audricia Harris. This was also said by other personnel at the Public Affairs Office, but I will only speak for what I was told personally in writing. So it was also told to me on the telephone, but I also made sure that I got everything in writing. That way that there was a paper trail. And they denied that they ever released those videos, no component of the Department of Defense. Now, for any of those that don't know, the Defense Intelligence Agency is known to be the original agency that housed ATIP, so to speak. So ATIP was run through DIA. In 2010, as confirmed by not only Mr. Luis Elizondo, but also the DIA itself, it was transferred out of the DIA in 2010 over to OSD. DIA never said OSD, but we can kind of deduce that because that's where Mr. Elizondo worked. The Pentagon has pretty much confirmed it was a real program. The question mark, though, is what do they mean by they never released these videos? Mr. Elizondo had said that they went through what's called a DOPSR process, D-O-P-S-R. Now, this is a review process outside of the Freedom of Information Act, but it allows for the department to clear either textual or video or photographic documents for release to the public. What the DOD told me through the Pentagon was that even though a DOPSR process is completed, that does not authorize anything for public release. It sounded like there is another step to go through that was not gone through for these videos. So at this point, they maintain that they never released them. Does that mean that they're fake? Not necessarily. I've said a couple times now, you know, we need to get an official version of what these videos were in their raw form, to make sure that the audio is legitimate and to make sure that we can see as much as we can see to give a little bit more context of what the videos are. We know that they're highly edited. We know that because, number one, they're compressed. And we know that because Mr. Elizondo said that there is a high-definition version. That's a different red flag in itself, but he says that there's a high-definition version, which has yet to be released. But we also see the To the Stars Academy watermarks, which means that they edited the video in some way.
Yes.
The audio, well, I have no reason to believe it's fake, but it's quite interesting when you listen to the pilots' voices and what they're saying. To me, that doesn't quite jive with what they would say, but I'm not going to say it's fake. I'm just saying there should be a little bit more evidence to show that what we're looking at truly is legitimate, because to me, I think it needs to be addressed that if Mr. Elizondo said, hey, look, the DOD released these, they declassified them. These are the first, I believe that they term it the first officially declassified, you know, UFO videos or UAP videos. The media has reported that, crediting them to the Department of Defense being officially declassified. There's no evidence of that. And in fact, it's quite the contrary. And it's not just because they said it to me. They have gone on the record to other outlets as well that have reported it. I believe Wired Magazine, but don't quote me on that, was one of them that did an expose on this and said the DOD denied ever releasing them. So it is factual and documented, and it is something that the DOD has confirmed.
We are
absolutely fascinating. Thanks, guys. Really great show.
Thank you. Appreciate the call. We're almost out of time already. Can you believe it, John?
Yeah.
Going back to what you just said there, I had a fighter pilot on the show and talked to him about that particular, you know, video, and he said that the lingo and the, you know, the banter back and forth, he said he didn't have any problem with that. He said,
yeah,
things are, you know, he said things like that are said. It's not unusual.
Yeah. So, and that's fine. Yeah. And that wasn't my only red flag. My question is, we just have to know that it's real. When we get a, this is officially declassified version, and then the other side is saying, hey, we never released it, I think that deserves addressing. And if the government's lying, we'll tack it on the list. You know, we've got a pretty big growing list of lies that we can prove. So if that's what it is, that's what it is. But I think that it deserves definitely a closer look and figure out what exactly is going on.
I think at one point you're really driving home here, and I agree with you wholeheartedly, is the truth. That's all we really want is the truth.
Yeah.
And that's the only way we're going to get anywhere, and we have to be believable. So I really appreciate that a lot, and it's been a real pleasure having you on the show finally.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Absolutely.
I can't believe 2 hours went by so fast.
Yeah. No, yeah. Absolutely.
All right. Excellent.
I don't know if you have time for that FOIA exempt thing, but I think you're coming up to the end here.
I'm right at the end, actually. I'm sorry to say. All right. Okay. So just throw out the title of your book one time, and we'll have to say goodnight. Yeah.
Yeah, no problem. Title of the book is Inside the Black Vault, The Government's UFO Secrets Revealed. And you can buy it at InsideTheBlackVault.com or Amazon or any brick-and-mortar store. I hear it's everywhere.
Excellent. All right, John. Thanks so much. You take care.
Thank you. All right, you too. Thanks again.
All right. Sure thing. Bye now. All right, everyone. So that is it for our show. And next week, we have Jim Peniston on from the Rendlesham Forest incident. That should be an interesting show. So stay tuned for that next week, same time. And thanks so much for listening. I want to thank everyone that helps out with the show, and you, the listener, especially. And don't forget to keep your eyes to the sky.